You're listening to a Day1.fm show.
Pick My Brain is the podcast where founders pitch me their startup and I try to give them some useful advice so they can connect better with potential co-founders, investors, media, and of course, customers. My name's Alan Jones and I was a founder myself for about 15 years, and after that an angel investor for another 15 years, so yeah, old. Some of my ventures have been successful and some failed disastrously, but I like to think I've learned a thing or two along the way, and maybe some of that can help you. So if you'd like to learn how to tweak your pitch, subscribe to the Pick My Brain show now, wherever you like to listen to podcasts.
I kind of describe BC Markets as a designated driver of Australian crypto.
Welcome to FinTech Fun. FinTech Fun is a podcast where Australian fintechs come to share their stories.
Hi, it's Chris Titley here. As part of the FinTech Fun podcast series, I'm joined by Caroline Bowler, CEO at BTC Markets. Caroline, thank you so much for being part of the series.
Thanks so much for having me.
Caroline, let's talk about you and your background and how that intertwined into BTC Markets and a little bit of a snapshot on BTC.
Yeah, great. So originally started my career in financial services in Ireland back in the day and working for a small private client broker. And so kind of got to understand the flow of the operational flow of traditional financial markets back when it was all paper-based. So my first job in finance was stuffing settlements envelopes with stock certificates and kind of, you know, as you can imagine, sitting there kind of counting through to make sure we had enough to settle trades. And then the first project I worked on was the dematerialization of stock certs into digital assets. And so I've kind of been kind of reinventing the same project over the course of my career.
You know what, I'm going to interrupt here for a second because that was my first job too, was stocking envelopes full of buy and sell contract notes. It was called a bookings clerk back in 2002 it was. And you also had to print the labels of the addresses too.
They are taking us all back.
That's it.
So started off doing that and then I kind of then, you know, bled across different functions from settlements into corporate actions and, you know, just across the whole gamut of financial services. And I think probably one of the advantages of working for a smaller broker is that you are expected to do so much more. You get the opportunity to be exposed to so much more. And certainly for me and my career, that's really been beneficial. And gave me a great start. And then I bounced from there. After a couple of years, I moved across to a US investment bank who had their operational team based out of Dublin. The European ops team was based out of Dublin. And so worked through there. I was working in interest compensation claims as I started doing next. I was known as the debt collector, which is a great title. But then understood a bit more about kind of the wider financial services industry. So going from kind of the basic operational flow into understanding more about the interconnectedness and you know, how investment banks engage with each other and how the wider financial markets operate, and moved with that investment bank to Singapore. And this was back, I signed in 2007, moved in January 2008, and then white knuckle for the next couple of years as we went through the GFC. Based out of Singapore. So my timing was excellent in that sense. But while I was there, I moved into a role in prime brokerage. So I moved from back office into front office. And so transferred onto an Asian trading floor and had a fantastic experience that was so formative, particularly when you think about like the hours that you work and the expectations that are on you in terms of delivery and particularly delivery for clients. Working through the GFC where our clients are all hedge funds is quite something, and certainly shaped a lot of my view around risk management. And that was just absolute paramount. And for a long time was the catch cry for the prime brokerage team, but also for the wider industry. So, and I think I've taken lessons from all three of those particular types of roles, that then kind of moved on into my career. So you know, started, as I say, then did prime brokerage, and then I left the bank and took something of a left-hand turn. I think people were quite surprised that I left what was a career that was going really quite well, and went back to university in Singapore, and I did a degree in communication. Actually, it was an Aussie university, with Murdoch University out of WA in Singapore, and did a degree in public relations. What I really liked about the prime brokerage role was around strategy and the strategic communication with clients to deliver best outcomes for everybody. And I enjoyed it so much, I went back to uni, did a degree in it, and then set up the first fintech primarily, and then blockchain communications strategic consultancy agency in the Asia Pacific region. So this is way back in the day when Bitcoin was still the only show in town when it comes to cryptocurrency, and fintech certainly was the far bigger player. And even then, it was still very much in its nascency. But I think where the benefit was is that understanding both of that, you know, traditional markets across the full gamut of traditional finance. And then being able to translate and understand and recognize the opportunities that were being presented by so many of these financial technology companies, these new companies coming through, embracing change and disruption and all the really fantastic benefits of applying technology, but likewise understanding the kind of constraints that operate within the technology functions of bigger institutions. So it really was fantastic. So started the business, grew the business, opened up an office here in Australia, and got a few Aussie clients, and ended up selling the business and moving permanently to Melbourne. And then that led me to the door of BTC Markets. They were one of my clients, and we always hit it off. I always really appreciated the way that they approach risk management. I always really appreciated how they were very much understanding that, you know, you're taking people's identification, you're handling other people's money, there's a lot of risks involved in that, and the importance for really good rigor and control around it from the very outset. And I think that perhaps, you know, I kind of describe BTC Markets as the designated driver of Australian crypto, in that we're all in it as well. Like we're coming along for the ride too. We all, you know, individually trade. The company itself doesn't trade. We don't have any proprietary trading. But as individuals in the business, we all trade. So we're along for the ride with you, but we're doing it, if you like, in a sober fashion, if I can use that designated driver analogy even further. You know, we're set up to try and mitigate as much of the risk as is possible around crypto, and just leave the investor in the best possible position to make the best investment decisions for their own needs and whatever it is that they're looking for their own portfolio. So that really rang true with me after, as I say, after the experience in the GFC. So delighted. It's been a dream since I came on board.
And Caroline, the education process, you're working for a communications company back in the day when you said Bitcoin wasn't only the only crypto in town, and the word blockchain. Mm. I mean, we're sitting here in 2022, however many years later. I mean, you find the same narrative over and over again.
I think this is the same narrative from when I was in settlements and I was trying to explain to people that because you no longer hold the stock certificate doesn't mean that it suddenly disappeared just because it's now a digital asset. And I have been selling that same message since, well, I suppose the late 90s, early 2000s. So that hasn't changed. But I think that once people understand the opportunity that's there, the people become quite enthusiastic about it and have great clarity around it. Like for most investors, you know, whether it's a digital asset or a paper certificate isn't really an important piece. What's important is around security, efficiency, ease of use, you know, the cost benefits, etc. That's what people really care about. Certainly for, you know, the investors that we deal with, whether you're, you know, an individual looking to, you know, put away a few dollars a month, or a large scale investment bank, there's still benefits still ring true. I think one of the problems that crypto has experienced, or blockchain has experienced, is that from the outset, the perception around it, the view that was kind of built up around it was one of perhaps being, I don't know, either a few people got too caught up in trying to understand and what a blockchain was all about, as opposed to looking at it from a benefits point of view. And I often enjoy to talk about, you know, I don't actually know how to code. Like, I don't know the technicalities between how a hypertext transfer protocol works, but I sure know what a website is, and I sure know the benefits of that. And I think perhaps people have gotten a bit too caught up in trying to understand what can at times be a rather complex technical issue, and losing sight of what the reality really is. I mean, that's not the case for everybody. I mean, some people can get into the weeds on it and, you know, flourish in that environment. Others don't. And I think that there's a sense of, oh, if I can't get under the hood of blockchain, then, you know, it's not for me. And that's just simply not the case. We're also incredibly early in all of this. It's still so new, but there is, you know, there's been an awful lot written about it, and an awful lot of, at times, cynical pieces that perhaps have tried to conflate this thing of blockchain is Bitcoin is crypto, and that's simply also not true. What may have been the case back in 2008 when the first white paper came out, that's no longer the reality at all.
The idea that it's all of one and it's all too daunting. You sort of triggered a memory when I was when you're speaking then about when I was growing up, and my father was English and speaking to his mother over the phone, and I would have been 7 or 10 or something along those lines, and you had to dial like 25 different numbers on a little landline and wait, and it'd connect, and then she'd say hello, and it was like this hallelujah moment, and for me, in my head, I was like, how on earth does that work? Like, it's just incredible that you're speaking to someone in the other side of the world. And then we're here 15, 25 years later or 30 years later and a similar technology, again, trying to work out how it works, but everyone's using it, so it's kind of like no one actually has well, there's a few that would have a huge in-depth knowledge, but the rest would just be uses of their application. I'm sort of digressing a little bit, Caroline, on that topic, but it's sort of similar. But going back to BTC in its own right, can you give some context to how they sit in the Australian market and a little bit of history about this? Some high-level numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've been around since 2013, based primarily here in Melbourne. The majority of our development team are based here, and we're very proud of that fact. I think that's been something of the philosophy of the founders from the outset, is that they wanted to keep the development onshore, they wanted to keep it in Australia, because there is a lack of blockchain developers naturally enough in this country. But because this is going to be so important in time to come, we need to start building out that skill set internally. So we're trying to do the little bit that we can, flying the flag, wearing the yellow and green, and keeping a lot of that development onshore or as much as possible. So there's a lot of IP kind of based around our development team. But we've got about, I think it's just under 40 people now based here in Melbourne. And then others that are kind of other roles that are just dotted around the country. We have got about 225,000 Aussies who've come on board, fully AML KYC'd. And that kind of goes back to that point I was talking about earlier, where there was this understanding from the outset that, you know, when you're dealing with people's assets, we need to be as stringent around our risk management and controls as we possibly could be. And I think from what I understand, one of the first hires, if not the first external hire to the business, was in fact a risk and compliance manager. So has brought in these processes from the outset. And then that's kind of paid off into some of the partnerships that we were able to deliver. Probably one of the better known ones was our partnership with Vault Bank. God bless Vault. They were a fantastic team to deal with and incredibly ambitious and just, as I say, I mean, marvelous, marvelous team to work with. So, and for those guys, I mean, for us to get the partnership with the bank, the rigor that they had to apply to who we were and what we were about to kind of satisfy their own regulator, obviously their relationship with APRA, was quite significant. And I think that probably speaks to then, you know, the other partnerships that we've been able to announce. I mean, most recently is probably the one strategic partnership with MasterCard that came through, I think in the last 6 months from memory, but again, trying to remember, who can even remember anymore?
Yeah, that's right. The world's moving so fast all a bit of a blur the last few years. Yeah.
It's all a bit of a blur. It's an after COVID kind of story with the MasterCard. But we have others, and we have others in the pipeline, other announcements to come in terms of the partnerships that we're working with. I suppose the other piece is we've also taken that risk management approach to other parts of the business. So we're looking at, we've got ISO certification 27001. We also are about midway or three quarter of the way through our SOC 2 compliance process, which is really meaty. And for an organization of our size, it's quite the task to take. But again, we kind of, with the lack of regulation and with the lack of, I suppose, of a framework to measure ourselves against, we just looked at what's come out of traditional finance. And again, my own background playing heavily on that and gone, okay, well, this is a standard that's used in financial services. Let's co-opt and adopt as much of that as we possibly can. So that's what we've done with the SOC 2. And then that's kind of translated further again into an AFSL process. So, more than 18 months ago at this stage, the whole process in total took 17 months, where we applied for an AFSL in our own right. And that, for a crypto company, was quite an undertaking. But we decided that rather than going out and just buying an AFSL, rather than just getting buying the license, I suppose we wanted to, A, to understand and get across the process ourselves. But likewise, you know, we were also keen to open up the doors, if you like, to ASIC, if they so wanted to feel a degree of comfort that a crypto exchange was getting an AFSL. So it was actually through our sister company, which is BTCM Payments, we managed to obtain an AFSL for non-cash payments and general advice. And now, as BTC Markets, we're an authorized rep of that sister organization and their license. So for us, you know, it's those are significant kind of foundational pieces that we can then build on, and for our clients that can have an increasing sense of understanding around the rigor that we apply to our risk management and how we're structured as a business. And I think if you look at what's happened in crypto over the last 4 months, having good risk management practices is actually a key differentiator, because we've certainly seen some of the instances that have happened due to perhaps a lack or weaker risk management being applied to different crypto businesses and decisions. Whereas, as I say, we're the designated driver, so we've just been playing the whole way through. So as I say, about 225,000 LDs, they've traded about, must be $22 billion with us at this stage. I would say that, you know, being around since 2013, we're certainly one of the longest standing crypto exchanges in the country, and certainly probably one of the largest, if not the largest, of the Australian crypto exchanges. And I think that's probably an important point too to educate people on. You know, we are a true peer-to-peer crypto exchange. So when you come on and trade on the platform, it's Mary from Ala Dala trading with Bob from Toowoomba, as I keep on trying to the analogy I draw. So it's a closed circuit. It's only Aussies trading with other Australians. And I think people take a lot of comfort and reassurance from that they're coming into an investment space that they may not necessarily be familiar with or comfortable with, but you're dealing with other Aussies who are feeling probably similarly, and there's a certain degree of comfort from that. And it's only paying out to Australian banks and Australian financial services. So again, an additional level, if you like, of comfort, kind of ring fencing around where those funds are. So yes, that's kind of the broader environment for B2C market. So we're also kind of moving further into, I suppose, a B2B kind of offering. Our partnership with Self Wealth has been publicized. People are aware of that. So Self Wealth will be making crypto trading available through their app via our exchange. So go to log on to a Self Wealth account and trade crypto, but the back end will be BTC Markets. And I think that's probably a trend that we're going to see. I mean, we certainly saw CBA come out with their own model last year or so. And I think we're going to see that increasingly across all of the different brokers. But if they're offering equity, they're also eventually inevitably going to be offering cryptocurrency as well.
Yeah, a Brisbane-based firm, SwiftX, here that we had on the show previously, are going down that route as well, or merging equities with cryptocurrency and potentially quote unquote super app. Even though I don't think too many people like that name, Caroline. When you in your downtime and you know, in between talking about blockchain and cryptocurrency and running a very thriving company, what do you get up to in terms of trying to switch off, or are you looking to go traveling now that the borders are sort of loosely open?
So I think, first of all, anyone who's been in cryptocurrency over the last couple of years is exhausted. I think any of us have had a chance to switch off for the last 2 years. Irrespective of lockdown, it's just been like a jetpack was attached to the back of the business and to the attack of the whole community over the last 2 years. So if anything, I really had to kind of make a very dedicated choice or specific choice to carve out some time. So I used to play Gaelic football in Singapore. I wasn't particularly good at it, but I had a great time doing it. And I then moved into coaching of Gaelic football while I was up there. And then when I moved here to Australia, I looked to kind of replicate the model. You see, I do something once and then just try and reproduce it across the line. So, and I do that in my personal life. So I've actually taken up coaching an AFLW team.
Oh, so, fabulous. Wow.
Yeah, so kind of transferred the skills across and having a wonderful time. Absolute ball. Love the team that I play with. Love the opportunity to hang out and with a particularly predominantly a bunch of women. We have also got some other members of different communities who are involved in our sport, and we love it. And yeah, it's just, I just really enjoy it. I'm not playing anymore. So I'm the person standing in what I call the dugout, although I keep having to change all my language because I'm still using
I know little known fact, I played Gaelic football. I actually represented Queensland for Gaelic football.
Yeah. Oh my God, that's amazing.
For many years, and we had Queensland were actually the national champions back in whenever it was that I played. Oh, I'd say the early 2000s. I went on two national tours. Yeah, so I didn't actually. Wow. I missed a World Cup, unfortunately, but I did get picked in the national team. But the national team was just a paper team, not a travelling team of the years that I played. But did have a few Irish backpackers that came over and inevitably played. Amateur/professionally in the couple of the teams. So actually miss watching Gaelic football, and never got into hurling though. They didn't let us. They didn't let the Australians play hurling because the dangerous mentality of it all. But certainly very, very close to AFL as most people are aware, and they used to have that international rules thing going on. A lot of AFL players.
You have to be a certain type of demented to play hurling. It's a wicked sport. It's fantastic. But you also have to embrace the fact that you may likely lose, you know, teeth, parts of your skull and other
things. Yeah, a little bit of some bruising.
Definitely bruising, at least you're worried. I mean, I also believe it's the fastest land sport because of the speed at which the hurl hits the slither and moves the ball down the field. It's the fastest field sport in the world.
We
digress. So I'm transferring those skills, they transfer across to AFLW, and it's fantastic, and I'm so fortunate, and I count myself very lucky to have made a great bunch of pals in that community. But I think sport probably plays that role for people all over the world, and particularly at community level. It's just so important, and such a backbone for communities, but particularly getting women and young girls into sport and to keep them to that is just, it's just so important. And I mean, I'm in my 40s and still kind of clinging on, please, let me get involved.
Yep.
And I'm
familiar.
Kind of working my way through the role. Yeah, I'm working my way through the role. I'll do the
– except I've got a pulled quad muscle, torn adductor and a hamstring.
There
all
you
those
go.
Things.
There you go. You're just going to retire to the bench.
That's right. I do. Who's your county? I remember when we when we played, well, I was prefaced to the fact that we played for Queensland, but we had a touring team. We had Connaught came over.
Connaught came over.
And we had their under 16 team play our under 18 team at the time. And under 18 team. And they gave us a good touch up. So our under 18 was nowhere near as good as their under 16 team. But it was very, very sort of leveling to know that we thought we were very, very good. And then we played a team 2 years younger than us from Ireland. And got touched up, so I'm interested to know who your county is.
Well, so my county, my family are actually from, or I was grew up in a county called Longford, which doesn't really punch very much above its weight when it comes to Gaelic football. But my mother's family, like where my actual, where we consider where the family are actually from, is Mayo,
right.
And so we're kind of first generation out of Mayo, so they would very much be the family team or the family county that we would support would be the county Mayo. And they are always the bridesmaid, never the bride. There is a mythology that's gone down in Mayo Gaelic football and in Gaelic football history in Ireland about how the last time Mayo won the All-Ireland, which is their version of the big grand final, the last time they won it, on their way back, a member of the team, or perhaps the whole team itself, I can't remember, slighted a priest who in turn put a curse on the team and said, until every single member of this team is dead, Mayo will never win another All-Ireland. Mayo have never won another All-Ireland, although they have always gotten through to the grand final. They've always made it through to the All-Ireland final. They are always the bridesmaids. Right. And so it's gotten to the point where people are kind of saying, do we want to hold a pillow over the face of the last player?
Right.
To try and give Mayo a chance.
There's a tradition of sport. There you go. All right. Well, maybe this year could be the year. I'm unsure of the seasons of when Gaelic football starts
maybe.
Or finishes. But
yes.
Maybe we've had this chat and now we've put the curse the other way. So, Caroline, on that note, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for giving us a snapshot of your life and certainly how you came about BTC and also the progress that BTC has made here in Australia, as you mentioned, Australian owned and operated and also liquidity based here in Australia, which I think is very important, as you mentioned. Congratulations on what you've achieved there and very much look forward to following the progress.
Thanks so much. Really appreciate it. All right, we'll talk to you again.
Thanks.
For more information on Sub11, jump onto our LinkedIn or email me, chris@sub11.com.au. Thanks for listening.
Listen to the Unfunded podcast brought to you by the Day One Network and hosted by me, tech writer Joan Westenberg. We're sharing the no-holds-barred, untold stories from entrepreneurs who have decided to build a business on their terms. I'll be interviewing successful founders and operators on the grit and ingenuity it takes to build and scale independent startups without the support of traditional venture capital funding. Subscribe to the Unfunded podcast now, wherever you get your podcasts.